call the meeting to order. This is an informational hearing today on a bill that is just introduced and also actually is being introduced and also was just voted on as an amendment into a bill in the higher education bill that just was in the committee that we're coming from. I'm a little bit late today. I apologize to members to have to wait for us, but this really is an informational hearing. I'm really pleased we were able to get some of our experts in the field to come to talk with us today about nanotechnology. Certainly an area where there are a major scientific and ethical issues that need to be discussed and which I think really haven't been, at least not in the legislature, legislative arena. And so we're going to be having some testimony today. I did want to just call your attention to the actual bill that's being introduced. And it is in your packets. It's got the reviser's name at the top, and it's 106301. I do want to indicate to you that there was one minor amendment that I added to this this bill, and I want to tell you about it. Basically, what the bill does is to say that our higher education institutions, the university and MNSCU organizations, must report to certain legislative committees on the ways that they are working to ensure that nanotechnology is used responsibly through the standards and guidelines that protect public health and environment and provide for occupational health and safety. In other words, what are they doing in the research that they're doing and the development that they're doing to protect those arenas when they're working with nanotechnology. The amendment that you could just write in now, and again when we get the bill before us, actually we will insert it on line 1.10 after the word higher education. We'd insert economic demands there. Yeah, we'd insert environment. So the committees then that would be reported to would be the Higher Education Committee, the Environment Committee, Economic Development, and Public Health Committees, which is this committee. So there we go. Those are the changes for that. And we are going to hear today from a couple of people who are experts and who've been working with these issues, and I'm really pleased to welcome as our first testifier, Dr. Steve Sapine, who is the Senior Policy Analyst for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And please take a seat at the table. Welcome to the committee, and you can introduce yourself if you'd like. I believe you've also given us a document. Several documents, maybe.
Yes,
sir. Yes. Hello? Yeah, it's on. It's recording.
Okay.
It's recording.
So I have given written testimony, as well as several documents that are referred to in the testimony. Good morning, I'm Steve Sapine, Senior Policy Analyst at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, otherwise known as IATP, where I've worked since 1994. IATP is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization headquartered in Minneapolis with offices in Washington, D.C. and Geneva, Switzerland. IATP thanks Chairwoman Clark and the committee for this opportunity to share with you some of our views about some of the regulatory and legislative challenges presented by nanotechnologies. Nanoscale science and technology manipulates matter at the level of 1 to 300 nanometers, or billionths of a meter. A human hair measures 80,000 to 100,000 nanometers. Nanoscale materials have novel properties that make them potentially useful for broad array of products. For example, nano-sized particles of DNA are arranged to mimic more powerfully and quickly the process by which a turbine digests wood to produce the sugars that could be used to manufacture cellulosic ethanol. Nano-sized carbon tubes are mixed into building materials to vastly strengthen them. According to the National Science Foundation, about $70 billion worth of products incorporating engineered nanomaterials were sold in the United States last year. Lux Research predicts a $3.1 trillion global market for nanotechnology products by the year 2015. The sum and substance of my testimony is this. Nanotechnology products have been commercialized in the absence of nanotechnology-specific U.S. federal regulation. These products continue to be put in the marketplace despite peer-reviewed scientific studies that show some nanomaterials have potential human health risks often based on laboratory studies with test animals. Most of these studies have focused on the respiratory system, with remarkably few studies on the effects of nanomaterials on the gastrointestinal system. I brought with me copies for the committee of a study on the potential for nanomaterials to cross the placental barrier and potentially affect fetal development. There is no official U.S. nanotechnology product registry. However, according to research by the Woodrow Wilson Center Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, there are about 1,000 consumer products incorporating nanomaterials currently on the market. In my testimony, I will very briefly review the readiness of just two U.S. federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration and the Environmental Protection Agency, to regulate nanotechnologies. The National Nanotechnology Initiative coordinates the activities of about two dozen federal agencies. For this committee and the legislature, understanding the extent of federal regulatory readiness will be helpful in determining what kinds of state oversight may be needed for nanotechnology product developers operating in Minnesota. Considering how many commercial products incorporate nanomaterials, it is remarkable how little information federal regulators have about those products and the related company product test data. They lack such information because there is no statute or rule requiring data submission as a requirement for regulatory approval. Much of nanotechnology product test data is claimed as confidential business information under the Administrative Procedures Act. It may be necessary to revise the APA to ensure that data required to ensure public health, the environment, and workplace safety is not withheld from regulators under claim of CBI privilege. EPA has acknowledged that its voluntary nanomaterials stewardship program has failed to elicit company cooperation and is considering development of a rule for mandatory submission with CBI protections. And here's a little parenthetical statement. The reluctance to regulate is not universal. The EPA's corresponding agency in Germany has called for a mandatory product registry and mandatory labeling of products with engineered nanomaterials. In an October 6th speech, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson said that the EPA would review how nanoscale materials should be reported under the Toxic Substances Control Act. The results of this review will presumably be communicated not only to nanotech product developers, but to all federal and state agencies with responsibilities for nanotechnology oversight. Lacking nanotechnology product data, federal authorities have performed no pre-market safety assessments of products that incorporate nanomaterials or claim to. In light of scientific evidence of the potential risks of nanomaterials in commercial use, IATP joined a May 2008 petition to the EPA to regulate nanosilver as a pesticide. EPA action on this petition is still pending. IATP remains concerned that the many promises of jobs and life-enhancing products made by a burgeoning nanotechnology industry may cause legislators and regulators to delay or dilute regulation in the mistaken belief that strong regulation and enforcement will impede product innovation. IATP believes, to the contrary, that to secure sustainable nanotechnology markets, there is an urgent need to authorize and implement pre-market safety assessments of products with novel materials that behave very differently from their macromaterial counterparts. I will not knowingly eat silver since it is toxic and indigestible. But if nanosilver becomes part of a vegetable or fruit coating to extend produce shelf life, shouldn't regulators have tested such a nanocoating for its health effects prior to allowing produce companies to use the nanocoating? Shouldn't such a nanocoated product, if approved by regulators, be labeled so consumers can choose whether or not they wish to consume such a product? Nanocoating of produce destined for the United States is not a hypothetical example. In a remarkable series of articles published March 24th, Andrew Schneider, Pulitzer Prize-winning health reporter, reveals that Latin American produce destined for the United States has been nanocoated. Schneider cites an anonymous USDA researcher as saying, quote, "We found no indication that the nanocoating, which is manufactured in Asia, has ever been tested for health effects," unquote. FDA is required to re-inspect the increasing volume of imported produce, to say nothing of drugs, medical devices, and other products under its authority. What is FDA's capacity to inspect and test nail-coated import produce? Congressional testimony about FDA's port of entry resources is instructive for estimating its regulatory readiness, since many of these products are the subjects of nanotechnology applications. In November 2007, former FDA Import Product Administrator Benjamin England testified that FDA had about 200 inspectors for about 300 U.S. ports of entry. To make up for this lack of port of entry capacity, FDA is negotiating bilateral agreements with major exporters to the United States that will allow FDA inspectors posted abroad to review the paperwork and conduct on-site audits to certify that export facilities follow U.S. safety standards. Implementation and enforcement of these agreements with countries having weak regulatory capacity, such as China, a major nanotechnology manufacturer, will not be easy. The FDA has a great deal of confidence that it will be able to manage risks associated with food applications and nanotechnologies. According to Dr. Annette McCarthy of FDA's Food Additive Office, quote, "For a lot of the nanotechnologies that are being designed at the moment, you would have a hard time today to come down to FDA and prove that it's generally recognized as safe," an FDA term known as GRAS. "But 2 years down the line, it could be a slam dunk. It could be very simple, that is, to prove GRAS," unquote. However, given the current effect of industry self-determination of what is GRAS, the General Accountability Office reported in February that nanomaterials could enter into commerce without FDA knowledge, which, to judge by Andrew Schneider's extensive reporting, is apparently the case. Now I want to turn to U.S. and state oversight of nanotechnology, a very kind of short state of play. The Congressional Research Service has published an excellent overview of U.S. legislative and budgetary support for nanotechnologies. The federal government has invested billions of dollars through the National Nanotechnology Initiative, launched by President Clinton in 2001. In 2003, Congress enacted the 21st Century Nanotechnology Research and Development Act, which provides a statutory basis for nanotechnology research programs, budgets, and prioritizes research initiatives, particularly for military, energy, and medical applications of nanotechnologies. Since its inception, the focus of the NNI has been product development, with minuscule investments, 1-2% of research dollars, to determine potential environmental, health, and safety risks of nanomaterials. In 2008, a National Research Council report joined many unofficial critiques of the NNI risk research plan. Following reauthorization of the National Nanotechnology Initiative in 2009, in January, Senators Mark Pryor and Benjamin Cardin introduced the Nanotechnology Safety Act of 2010, the first bill to require a dedicated EHS program, budgeting $25 million annually for the purpose. According to a Project on Emerging Nanotechnology study, as of May 2007, 47 of 50 states and the District of Columbia contained at least one of the 637 companies, 138 university and government laboratories, and 45 other types of organizations working in nanotechnology, unquote. By 2010, these numbers will have increased. Minnesota is among those states whose universities and companies are developing or have developed products with nanomaterials. For example, on May 19th, Medtronic and other Minnesota companies will showcase a broad array of nanotechnology applications. I have not been able to survey state legislation on nanotechnology nor state investments in nanotechnology. The Penn study, the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, outlines some state and local oversight initiatives and scenarios in which state or local governments may be required. Oversight of manufacture and storage of nanomaterials, air quality concerning nanoparticulates, manufacturing water discharge with nanomaterials, construction with nanomaterial products, and nanomanufacturing workplace safety are just a few of the areas in which states or even local governments might wish to act, particularly if federal legislation and regulation are delayed or underappropriated. I do not know the extent to which the state of Minnesota has planned to regulate nanotechnology products or the extent to which the state and federal agencies communicate about such regulatory planning. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's strategic plan for 2008 includes, quote, a new goal to build on the state's capacity to address emerging environmental issues such as endocrine disrupting compounds and nanotechnology, unquote. It would be helpful to know what MPCA has done and how it's planning to build its capacity to monitor and enforce any statutes that the legislature may authorize for nanotechnology. However, MPCA's historical approach to targeting resources according to its inventory of pollutants defined in terms of volume will likely need to change to monitor nanotechnology. The quantity of nanomaterials that may cause environmental and or public health harm will be much smaller in volume than what MPCA has traditionally inventoried. Prioritizing when and where to monitor pollutants will be a difficult task because potential risks of nanomaterials are not indicated simply by their size, but also by their configuration and shape. To the extent that Minnesota and the FDA have cooperative programs on food inspection and food facilities inspection, responsible state agencies will want to keep informed about gaps in federal nanotechnology oversight and shortfalls in regulatory capacity. State agencies should inform the legislature periodically about the cooperation with federal agencies on a broad range of products incorporating nanomaterials, particularly in the medical device industry in which Minnesota is global. While state agency reporting to this committee and others with responsibilities over the environment and workplace safety will aid the legislature in assessing oversight needs, I hope that the committee will not neglect to continue to request testimony from non-governmental representatives, even if sometimes they may seem like voices in the wilderness. Let me close with a few recommendations of the Transatlantic Consumer Dialogue for Regulating Nanotechnology. IATP is a decade-old member of the TACD, which will meet with U.S. and EU European Union officials to discuss these recommendations and others on April 27th in Washington, D.C. First, establish mandatory reporting schemes to keep track of the introduction into the marketplace of manufactured nanomaterials. Without product data, no effective regulation is possible. Second, develop and adapt regulatory frameworks to address the specific characters of nanomaterials and provide the statutory authority to do so. Third, develop testing methodologies adapted to nanoparticles and apply these methodologies throughout the life cycle of products with nanomaterials. Fourth, but by no means last, establish commissions to study the social and economic consequences of existing industries and commodities by industries based in manufactured nanoparticles. If nanotechnology and other converging technologies are to launch a new industrial revolution, public discussion of the consequences of such a dramatic shift will help guide public investment in socially optimal applications of nanotechnologies. IATP wishes to thank the committee for this opportunity to share some of our views on this critical public policy, technology, and business development issue.
Thank you, Dr. Supan. Comments or questions from committee members? I'm going to just give you a little bit of feedback on a couple of points that you made. One was on the last page, we just talked about to what extent has the state of Minnesota planned to regulate nanotechnology products. I'd say the answer is zero to date. I don't know of any part of our state agency that's doing that. I'd be glad to be proven wrong, but I am not aware of any. And having passed the amendment in the Higher Education Committee just a few minutes ago, I think we'll begin to ask at least some accountability from our research institutions to start telling us about just their guiding principles and ethical standards that they have in place or are developing. And it is my understanding, and committee members, I should tell you, there is an invitation from the University of Minnesota. There's a conference, I believe, that you all have in your packet that's tomorrow.
We don't have that.
We don't have our packet? Oh, we'll forward it. Okay, thank you, Jake. To talk about this issue, and I believe Dr. Supan is testifying there too, or providing information. This is very convenient for us as legislators, of course, but I guess if we have any staff that might want to go, I think it would be quite important. So, authors and legislator who happens to be freed up enough or are willing to, you know, go spend the day there, I'd really encourage that. Other comments? Questions from committee members? Well, I have a few. I don't want to monopolize the time if others have questions, but I'll ask a couple more questions. And one of the statements that that you have made and that others have made is that these very minute particles in the products in which they're become immersed or contained in, they act differently than the other macro particles that may be similar to them. Can you describe, like, what are we talking about here in terms of some of the different actions? What are some of the risks and so on that we should be concerned about and that would lead to some sort of regulatory framework?
Well, one of the advantages of nanoparticles is that they have greater surface contact. So, for example, nanosulfur added to agrochemicals is supposed to kill whatever the pest object is with a smaller quantity of agricultural chemicals because of a greater surface. There are some nanosized materials which are inert in their macro form but are explosive, obviously very small explosives, but still explosive in their nano form. There are materials which are solids in their macro form, but liquid in their nano form. There are some materials that change color, although I don't know, that that would present a health, environment, or safety problem. I should clarify that I'm do not have an academic background in the array of scientific and engineering disciplines that are use in nanotechnology, and so my background on this really comes from general good regulatory practice with, you know, as much reading as I've been able to do on the actual science itself. One issue I think is really a matter of technological assessment and technological choice. One of the products that I studied is cellulosic biofuel, made through synthetic biology, which is otherwise called nanogenomics. And there are different technological pathways. One pathway is to engineer enzymes and keep those enzymes in fermentation tanks. So if a nanotechnology or a synthetic biology process goes awry, you autoclave the tank and you start over again. On the other hand, there are projects by Syngenta, Monsanto, and maybe some other companies to engineer these enzymes in the cellulosic materials themselves, which if the genes with that are so engineered outcross to other plants, this could present some public health problems. So there are, you know, some technological pathways, technological assessment issues that have to do with the characteristics of nanoparticles and in nanobiotechnology, what they call nano-enabling processes.
Okay. And you mentioned the enzymes, and that sort of brings me back to one of your original comments about very few studies on the effect of nanomaterials on the gastrointestinal system in animals as well as in humans. Nobody's looked at this? They looked at it. Do we know?
I have to believe that the companies that are that have invested a lot of money in putting nanomaterials into food packaging and into food itself have done some studies. But these, for the most part, aren't publicly available. And the House of Lords Committee on Science and Technology published a study in January in which they said that when their investigators went to the United Kingdom's Food Standards Agency and asked to see, what was the list of research that that the Food Standards Agency had commissioned on gastrointestinal effects of nanomaterials, the agency wouldn't even tell the House of Lords how many contracts to for such studies had been commissioned. So there's what the House of Lords called unnecessary and inappropriate secrecy, partially because of the issue around confidential business information, which usually concerns, but not always, pending patent issues before the patent, or pending applications in the patent offices.
Yeah, that's a concern, because I know one of the things about the European Union is that they do have, at least I've understood that they've had in place a precautionary principle around certain consumer, around products, and mostly consumer products are where we're mostly concerned, because I do understand that there, now, not only are these nanomaterials apparently being used in our foods, some of them imported, I don't know if they're being used by any American food companies, that would be something I guess we could try to find out. But I'm surprised that in England they were not able to, under their precautionary principle, if they do have it in effect, were able to find out, you know, what this particular company was doing and what.
The application of the precautionary principle is an issue for each member state, and some member states apply it very vigorously, such as Germany. And some member states do not. In the case of the United Kingdom, the Food Standards Agency told the House of Lords that if they were to require a mandatory submission of nanotechnology product data, that those companies might take their business abroad. To countries where there would be no mandatory submission. And as we've seen with the EPA, voluntary submission of test data simply hasn't worked. And the EPA itself has admitted that, and I think that's why Administrator Jackson has decided on a review of this whole voluntary nanomaterial stewardship program.
And do we know, for example, just focusing on foods again, do we know what the materials are, for example, that Mexico is putting on the food products that we're importing from there? Or they're Asia, they're created in Asia. Do we have any idea what are they derived from? What are we talking about? Are these some of the silver products? Are these other things? Do we have any idea?
Again, according to Andrew Schneider's reporting, the most likely component is nanosilver, which is a germicidal. But I honestly do not know, you know, what other materials might be nano-sized. Some of the applications to me of nanotechnologies, I think, have great potential for profound social benefit, including some applications by companies in Minnesota. There are other applications which I quite frankly don't understand. Unilever is said to be making a ice cream that gives you that creamy, full, mouthy feeling with, you know, nanomaterials, nanoemulsion, both without the calories. You know, and to me, that, you know, given the lack of gastrointestinal studies, that to me seems like an awfully risky research project. Given, you know, Unilever's many brands, I would think their brand reputation would suffer should any of their products be shown to adversely affect human health.
I know another arena where I know there are nanoengineering happening is in the whole makeup area. And I know that there's been some concern. You know, there's not a requirement that toxic materials used in makeup be listed. Labeling of makeup products has been something that some folks have been working on for a while to require mandatory labeling of what in the world is in makeup. But I understand that there's nanoengineering in some of the makeup products now. And one of the things that concerns me about possible harm. I mean, maybe it makes great makeup, but on the other hand, these particles, as I understand, penetrate very deeply into the body, or can have the potential to penetrate very deeply into the body. Sometimes under a controlled medical regime, maybe that would be desired, but perhaps not if it's, you know, a general consumer product that people don't even know that it's in the product they're using. And I'm just wondering, there are no states, or at least I think what you said is maybe you have not, or others have not yet done a survey of states to find out if there are any regulatory or reporting or registering kind of agencies being created?
The project on Emerging Neon Technologies has done, you know, a kind of partial survey, and that study is in your information packet.
Okay.
You know, I think there's probably, my understanding is that the issue of first concern to states and localities has to do with workplace and laboratory safety of technicians working with nanomaterials, mm-hmm. Especially regarding respiratory issues. The cosmetics, the incorporation of nanoparticles in cosmetics really puzzles me. As I understand it, you know, zinc oxide makes sunscreen transparent. I don't know, you know, how much value that has for sunscreen as a product, but there's a lot of concern that children particularly might inadvertently lick the sunscreen. You know, so there are some sort of unexpected vectors for, you know, potential health public health problems. I guess I'm just puzzled about why these companies have chosen to incorporate those nanoparticles. I can't believe that the shelf life of sunscreen is, you know, so greatly extended or need extension by the incorporation of nanoparticles.
Okay. I guess one of the other issues you raised, and actually on the bonding committee tour, I did raise this question. In Dakota County, they're very proud of their Technical Institute. They're very proud of their nanotechnology project they've got. They're going there. I think they're trying to vie with the university for, you know, claiming that they're you know, premier leadership in the state of Minnesota. And I did ask one of the people in charge there, how were the students who were doing the research and development at that institute, how were they protected? What kind of occupational or health and safety measures they might have in place? And I think we have somebody here from either that institution or Minsky who can talk with us about that. But in general, that kind of awareness, I think, is not yet well understood by legislators or maybe even you know, the general public or students in general who might be looking to that industry. So I don't know. Any other questions, concerns, comments from members? Are you interested in this issue? You think it's a public health issue we ought to keep looking at? I guess I am concerned that there's such a lack of development of any sort of public health framework for this. It really does concern me that around the country we're rushing to commercialize a lot of products and we don't know what the impact is of these incredibly powerful, hopefully powerful for good most time, but maybe raising some big risks as well. Okay, we do have a couple more testifiers. Oh, go ahead. Representative Lane.
I think that most of us are quiet because it's bottom line information. We're just learning about it. I've heard something in the airwaves in the earlier times, and I've had some interest in what is this and are there hazards, but I have no information to go on. So I very much appreciate your coming and giving us this.
Well, thank you very much. And if you're free or your staffs are free to go to the to the University of Minnesota conference tomorrow on nanobiotechnology, you'll learn from people much more expert than I. But thank you once again for this opportunity to share some of our views with you. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
We'll be back before your committee.
Thank you so much. We're glad to have somebody in Minnesota looking at this. Thank you. Okay, we have asked folks from the different educational institutions to join us. Gail O'Shane from Minsky, would you like to come and talk with us a little bit about your perspective on this issue? There might be others in the audience, too, who would like to testify. We'd be glad to make time for you. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair Clark. My name is Gail O'Kane. I work in the Office of the Chancellor at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, where I support emerging technology programs and assist them in their work. We have with us today, in addition, actually, a true expert in nanotechnology, which I am not. Deb Newberry is here from Dakota County Technical College, and I don't know.
Welcome her to the
time.
Sure, come right ahead. Mm-hmm.
So thought would make sense would to give you be to start by providing an overview of the extent to which we do have nanotechnology related programs in our system.
Great.
We just heard about this hearing and bill yesterday afternoon, so the list I have may not be comprehensive. But certainly I know, I can tell you about the programs that are solely focused on nanotechnology, and I'll try to give you a feel for other programs that may work on technologies at a nano scale. We have three programs that are specifically focused on nanotechnology at this time. They're all at the two-year college level. Dakota County Technical College, I'm going to let Deb tell you about that program. It is not only the first two-year comprehensive nanotechnician training program in the country, but it is also the home to the only NSF-funded Advanced Technological Education Center in Minnesota. The NSF ATE program is the National Science Foundation's primary program funding community colleges. The types of awards they give out are at different levels, and the center is the highest level. And our first center of any kind in this state is the Nanotechnology Center, which is a multi-state center that Deb directs. So she'll have some great information to share with you about the program and the center. We also have a program that's part of that collaborative center, that is a part of that consortium that collaborates with DCTC. And that's a program at Minnesota State Community and Technical College in Moorhead that actually is delivered collaboratively across the border with the North Dakota State College of Science. And most of the actual laboratory work is done on the North Dakota side of the border at their Nanotechnology Center. That program is very much like the program at Dakota County Technical College. Deb actually knows quite a bit about that program, so I'd expect she could answer questions about that one as well. They train technicians broadly and to work in technology companies that operate at the nanoscale, as well as manufacturing companies that operate at the nanoscale.
That'd be accurate.
Yep. And then the third program that's focused specifically on nanotechnology is at Normandale Community College. And that's a little different. They focus on a particular area of technology where a lot of work is, a lot of the products are at the nanoscale. So that's the semiconductor and thin film area. And they don't actually work on nanoparticles or nanomaterials. They look at and characterize thin films, is my understanding, where particulates are not are not free in the environment. They're actually adhered to semiconductor films. So all of those programs have their, and all the programs in our system operate under OSHA standards and a variety of federal, state, and even county regulations that they have to operate under. Deb can talk about some of the special measures that are taken at Dakota County. At North Dakota State College of Science, which again is part of the, collaborates with the Moorhead College, I guess there are two issues here. One is to the extent to which we're educating students about the societal implications and the ethical issues around nanotechnology, and the extent to which when we work with any nanomaterials that it's done in a safe way for students. And so what the people told me at the North Dakota Moorhead program was that they have a required course in the societal and ethical aspects of technology, and they are also developing a nanotoxicology course that will cover environmental aspects as well as safety issues. And both of these courses are going to be are either now or will soon be available online. They also explained that in addition to the kind of regulations, safety regulations that are required and those that are recommended by vendors with any of the equipment they use at the nanoscale, they actually go above and beyond what's suggested by the vendors in handling any kind of nanomaterials by using such things as glove boxes and vacuums to deal with nanoparticles. Deb, I'm sure, can speak to those things with a lot more authority than I can. In addition to those programs that are focused on nanotechnology, we also have research being conducted at some of our state universities. The one I know of for certain is St. Cloud State University, has an electron microscope. They explain that they operate under they're careful to follow all of the federal and other regulations they have to follow in this manner. They also have a lab that works at the nanoscale, but only in simulation. And so what they do is they're able to operate and learn quite a bit by simulating nanomaterials. The final program that I will mention that has nano capabilities is St. Paul College, which has a clean room that was funded by an allocation from the state legislature. While they do have nanotechnology capabilities there, they are not currently operating at the nano scale. The projects they're doing are at a larger scale than that, and so it wouldn't really pertain to this particular legislation. I would expect that we have other state universities that also have capability of operating at the nano scale. We'll have to do a little bit more research to find out which ones. I would expect MSU Mankato does, mm-hmm. and perhaps Winona State would be
Southeast Tech too. Program there.
Okay, and you can talk. Perhaps mm-hmm. you can talk about that one, Deb. So that's the information I have on the existing nano programs. Deb can talk more about the DCTC program and in particular the kind of work they're doing on safety and ethics at DCTC.
Thank you so much. Maybe we'll hear from the next witness and then if there's questions for do them together. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Newberry.
Hi, I'm Deb Newberry. It's a pleasure to be here. I was actually planning on spending my day down in the lab working with nanoparticles today mm-hmm. instead of being over in St. Paul. So it's very appropriate. The topic is in sync with what you want to hear. My educational background is nuclear physics and chemical engineering. I spent 23 years working in the corporate world for Control Data, which then became Ceridian, which then became General Dynamics, predominantly building electronic satellite systems for space applications and doing a lot of radiation analysis on those systems. I started working with nanotechnology in 1991 with NASA because NASA was looking at using nanocomposite materials that would be like a powder nanoparticle mixed in with a polymer or a plastic to try and make the satellites weigh less but still have the mechanical and electrical integrity that is required for space systems. And so that was kind of my first introduction into nanotechnology. Since that time, I've been involved in the National Science Foundation working group for the societal impacts and implications of nanotechnology. I'm part of a consortium down in Texas, which involves Rice University and Austin Community College that is specifically addressing the issues of nanotechnology from a nanotoxicity standpoint or from an implication standpoint. Toxicity can imply such a negative connotation, but how does nanotechnology impact the environment and living biological systems? And we are also in the process, I'm working with Texas and Oklahoma to create a specific nano safety program that would be geared toward employees that end up working with nanoscale materials. I'm also working with the University of California in Santa Barbara and Foothill Community College up in San Francisco, integrating nano safety aspects into their nano-related and biotechnology-related programs. Finally, I'm also involved with the IEEE Research and Policy Development Committee, as well as the American Society of Mechanical Engineers Standardization Committee and the Nanotechnology Council. Through this umbrella of professional organizations, I've been involved in the attempt and working evolution of creating standards for nanotechnology. What is a nanoparticle? What does that mean? And there are some definitions that are still very gray. There are standard procedures that need to be written. There are safety guidelines that need to be written. So that's kind of where I'm coming to this group from a historical background. In terms of the language that is proposed, I personally do not have a problem with the language and believe that both the University of Minnesota, who is a partner with DCTC in our nanoscience technician program, would have any issues fulfilling the obligations of this language. But the one thing that I do need to make really clear is the expectations in terms of the language in 1.13, with regard to standards and guidelines. Right now, nanotechnology, dealing with things at the molecular and atomic level, is a new vocabulary word, but actually, you know, biologists, chemists, physicists, we've been doing nanotechnology for decades, centuries. The Egyptians used nanotechnology methods to create the beautiful shine that is on some of their statues, is because of a process that involves nanotechnology. Of course, they didn't necessarily call it that then. But it's been around for a long time, and part of the issue now with nanotechnology is there do not exist standards and guidelines for nano safety or nano use or nano disposal of nanoparticles. Those standards just plain and simple don't exist. And part of the problem, or the justification, the reason for that non-existence, is that the issue is extremely complicated, in the sense that whether a particle at the nanoscale will have a positive or negative impact depends upon what that particle is made out of, what size it is, how big it is, how much of it there is, how much it's been, how long it's been there, what it is interacting with, as well as, for a human body, whether it was inhaled, ingested, rubbed on, or injected. So you can imagine from those 12 things that I said that there's a bunch of variables. For every nanoparticle produced, you need to go through a whole series of variations to decide, is this thumbs up or is this thumbs down? And, you know, I'm certainly familiar with a lot of the peer-reviewed journal reports that were referenced by the previous speaker, but there is also, I just want to kind of say the other side of the seesaw, there's also a lot of peer-reviewed journal articles that say, hey, gold nanoparticles this size work just great. They don't show any toxic effects, they deliver drugs very well. The Mayo Clinic down in Rochester, Dr. Mark Swanson, is doing a lot of work with nanoparticles in the lung systems and is finding very distinct differences between a cylindrical-shaped nanoparticle that is inhaled, so I'm already defining the shape, the material, how it got into where it got. There's a very different level of toxicity or body response on whether we're talking a spherical gold nanoparticle or a cylindrical nanoparticle. So I'm just kind of using these as examples to say it's not an easy issue to address. It's kind of like if I had a stick of butter, and if I would have thought of it, I would have stopped a quick trip on my way here. If I had a stick of butter and I stuck that in my ear, probably nothing too bad's going to happen to me, except my hearing may get worse than it already is. I could take that stick of butter, rub it all over my body. You know, like my grandmother used to say, oh, you got to burn, put butter on it. You know, that's probably not going to do anything, except it may improve my cuticles, may get smoother skin. But if I ingested, if I ate that entire stick of butter, I bet my doctor might have a little bit of a problem with what that's doing to my cholesterol count for a short time frame. And so that is an example of the type of questions, the type of work that needs to go on in defining whether a nanoparticle, and I'm going to define a nanoparticle as a man-made object that is less than 100 nanometers in at least two dimensions. Okay, so that is not the thin films that Gail's talking about. It's not even the antibiotic coating that we put on stents to prevent the blood clots and all of that. Those are very thin, a few atomic layer thin coatings that we can put on implantable or embeddable medical devices to help prevent the blood clotting or infection setting in. Those are nanoscale thin films, but when I'm talking about a nanoparticle, I'm almost talking about something that you can make it very large, that you could hold in your hand, an object, maybe a cylinder or a sphere, a pyramid, diamond shapes. You can make them all amazing shapes. So when I use the word nanoparticle, particle. Deb Newberry is talking about something man-made, something that is nanoscale, less than 100 nanometers in two dimensions. That's the Deb Newberry definition. There's about 100 other definitions of what a nanoparticle is. I mean, I could say a potassium ion is a nanoparticle, a carbon ion. The oxygen, nitrogen, I just breathe. The O2 molecules are nanoparticles. Drive behind a diesel bus, you're inhaling nanoparticles. You buy a bottle of Bayer aspirin tablets, and there's that powder in the bottom. I could take that by scanning electron microscope and show you there's a bunch of nanoparticles there. So we need to make a distinction in terms of what we're talking about. And when I talk about nanoparticles, it's man-made and it's an object. Now, getting over to a little bit of the safety, and one of the reasons I went through that whole little lecture on all those 12 things is because most of the things that my students and I deal with at Dakota County Technical College, and this is also true for what happens in North Dakota and Minnesota, Southeast Mankato, are truly nanoparticles. It's really neat. We make gold nanoparticles, we make silver nanoparticles, and then we watch how they destroy bacteria. Better than Listerine, Lysol, better than prescription drugs. It's amazing. At the nanoscale that they have this property that we may be able to take advantage of. However, for those nanoparticles, the general consensus, and this is based on the American Chemical Society, how they treat nanoparticle chemicals. The powders, chemistry labs, and chemical engineering is in my background, chemistry labs are a dangerous place to be. I mean, they can be. It's not. And so in a lot of cases, if you apply the traditional approaches that you apply wisely to hazardous chemicals, both in the storage, in the containment, how you use them, you're going to be protecting yourself against the nanoparticles. So that means you keep your nanoparticles in a solution or in a gel. You don't let them become airborne, which is kind of why the airborne aspect, based on industry surveys that NIH work and the NSF work, airborne seems to be the least controllable of nanoparticles getting into a biological entity or into the environment. If you have them in solution, they tend to be a lot easier to control. As I said, we can certainly provide a report that talks about the ways we are wisely protecting students, how we're working with companies like 3M and Hyzotron and Boston Scientific. You know, it's a collaboration between industry and the educational institutions within our state and within the five-state region of the Regional Center for Nanotechnology Education. Working that collaboration between industry and education to make sure that we are being as smart as we can be in lieu of hard federal or state guidelines. And I think that in terms of the report that you would get in February, I just want to be real clear in setting the expectations that we can't go to a set of national standards and have a list of standards and make a bunch of checks, because right now there's a lot of people involved in the production of those standards, which is something I would like to get the state of Minnesota involved in more. And if there's any extra funding available, I'd be happy to use it to our advantage to create some of these guidelines and validate some of the guidelines and methodologies and procedures, because they do not exist. I think I addressed everything.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you so much. Questions and comments from committee members? Well, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see if I can work this kind of microphone.
Looks good. I just wanted to maybe talk a little bit about, you mentioned the nanotechnology being effective in destroying bacteria as one really positive use. What are some of the other ways that, if this is proven to be safe, can benefit us in our lives, in our daily lives?
Oh,
Ms. Newby.
I'm running through my list and trying to prioritize, which is why I'm being silent for a moment. One of the ways that immediately came to mind was the flu masks or surgical masks. You know, when we were a few months ago, when we were much more concerned about the H1N1 outbreak, a lot of people were buying surgical masks. And I'm going to tell you something which you may not like to hear, but the opening in those traditional surgical masks that you buy at Walgreens or Target or Walmart are 500,000 nanometers in size as a minimum. A virus is 100 nanometers in size. A bacteria is 1,000 nanometers in size. So although those masks may keep out dust and pollen and some of that other stuff, they might not work very well against a virus. One of the places of nanotechnology applications is creating the ability, and this was patented by the Donaldson Corporation. 3M also has a similar methodology in their much more expensive but very thorough masking systems that they have. In creating, nanotechnology has been applied to create filtering systems that can, yea verily, indeed, keep out viruses and microbes and parasitics. One of the examples we talk about in our class for societal applications is I tell my students there's the technology to create a piece of paper-sized filter that not only filters out sand and dirt, but filters out parasites and microbes and bacteria. Think of what a filter like this would mean to a lot of the third world developing countries where they have thousands, millions of people dying because of parasitic infections. Problem is right now, folks, and this is, you're my class, cost me 25 cents to make one piece of paper, and I'd really like to sell it for 30 cents. But my audience, the people, my customers, the people that need it the most, don't have 2 cents. What is my societal obligation with this very safe, benign? I have just learned to create cotton fibers, and fibers that are made out of natural materials. So is this even a nanoparticle? Because it's not man-made, I'm taking cotton. But I've figured out a manufacturing process to get those fibers to weave very, very tightly together, like the 500 thread count Egyptian sheets, right? But even smaller, much smaller than that. So what is my obligation to those people from a nanotechnologist scientific standpoint? If you create a nano idea that can benefit the world, what's going to win? And it's a rhetorical question to my students. Are you going to create your own startup company and become a millionaire and then donate your money and product, or are you going to do it first? And it's more of a rhetorical question, but it's something that I talk with my students, and we have a discussion about this. What if you create something on the other side? What if you create something that you realize is very hazardous? What is your moral obligation? What if you're mixing stuff and you have a precipitate and you know that it's a man-made, you made it, nanoparticle, and you realize that as soon as you're just setting it out, people start sneezing, or you start sneezing, or you start coughing, or whatever. What do you do? And we talk about what would be the steps that you would take. What is your obligation to something like that? And that's the same type of questions that a lot of these standards and guidelines committees are asking. What should be the procedure? Right now, OSHA and the government has a procedure. If you break a light bulb, if we break a light bulb, fluorescent or otherwise, in the lab, there is a procedure we can go to that tells us how to clean up that broken light bulb. If my students spill a solution of gold nanoparticles, there isn't a process yet for how to clean up those particles. Now, we use the typical process that we would use within DCTC for an infected blood spill. That's what we assume. We assume that it's the same as if, because we're trained in how to deal, you know, with bodily fluids that may be infected. And you put on the masks, you put on the gloves, you use special wipes, there's special disinfectants. Now, the disinfectant isn't going to do much for my gold nanoparticles, but it will suck it up. Right now, that's about as wise as we can be. And the gold nanoparticles, the 30 nanometer gold nanoparticles, Mark Swanson, I'm pretty comfortable with those. Gold is pretty biologically benign. And so if I get a few gold nanoparticles on my hand, I'm not too worried. The cosmetic issue, I just want to address that. I'm actually 92 years old, and I've been using nanoparticle cosmetics for a long time. Now, we say those are nanoparticles, and that's true. But what they are is they're nano-sized molecules of collagen and vitamin E. Now, based on the Deb Newberry definition of a nanoparticle or a nanomaterial, is that or is that not a nanoparticle? A molecule of water, well, shoot, I've got to take 3,000 nanoparticles or 3,000 water molecules to make a ball of water that is 30 nanometers in diameter or something like that, some thousand numbers. Is that a nanoparticle? Now we would say no, because it's made up of water, which is natural. But yes, Deb, if you did something to get it into that specific configuration, is that a nanoparticle? So there are certainly a lot of things to talk about out there. And Gail had mentioned in a previous conversation that, you know, we seem to have this thing that if it's man-made, it's bad, but if it's nature-made, it's good. Well, there's poisonous frogs out there and hemlock, and there's a lot of stuff, a lot of plants I wouldn't want my kids to eat. And so there is the need for a lot of discussion. And again, with what you're asking here from a DCTC Minsky standpoint, and I kind of am making the assumption that I'd be the one involved in responding to this request, I think it can be done, but please be aware, committee folk, that there aren't standards that we can necessarily start checking ourselves off against yet. But we are being wise. The NSF is being wise. The NIH is being wise. And granted, as the previous speaker mentioned, there's perhaps a small amount involved in the toxicity aspect of a lot of the nanotechnology research. It is there. Every researcher that I've talked to is very aware of paying attention and observing what's happening in the nanotechnology research that they're doing. And kind of the phrase for nanotechnology researchers is, we don't want to be another nuclear power or another GMO. So we're trying to be as open with government, with the public, as we can about what we're doing, because that's the only way we're gonna have an open conversation when we need to have one. Now I'll be quiet.
That sounds fine. Did you have a follow-up at all?
I just had one quick one.
Sure.
You really intrigued me with the whole mask scenario. And one of the things we just discussed this last, a couple of days ago, was a new policy handed down by the EPA for the cleanup of, well, anytime you break into something that has lead in your home.
Mm-hmm.
It was built before 1978. So would one of those masks filter out lead particles?
Probably. Those are probably agglomerated together, so they'd be large enough. Yep, you're going to be okay.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Professor. You were talking about nanoparticles, giving the thumbs up and thumbs down. Could you describe what a thumbs down particle would be? And sort of a second part of that, and Dr. Supan, you may have gone over this. Can you talk a little bit more about the products that might contain airborne nanoparticles?
Airborne nanoparticles.
Ms. Mabey.
That's a two-part question, right?
Okay.
Okay, based on what I am reading, if there is a category of nanoparticles that would be getting the thumbs down, it's more of the cylindrical or needle the one where your height or length to width ratio is greater than 10. So long, skinny things. Think asbestos, although asbestos has those barbs and stuff, which the jury is still out on whether it's the barbs or the actual, just the fact that it's long and skinny that caused the issue. But based on the journal reports that I have read and talking to folks like Kristen Kolonowski and Jim Tour down at Rice University, which is a very strong center for nanotechnology toxicity and implications from a health environmental standpoint, it appears to be things that are shaped cylindrically our body doesn't like, as well as things that are spherical or even triangular. Our body is almost happier with a triangle than it is with a cylinder. Now, it's interesting, this is a tangent, but it's interesting that a lot of antigens, the bad guys, antibodies are the good guys, antigens are the bad guys, microbes and stuff are cylindrical. You look at a lot of microbes and those types of bad guys that our body naturally fights against, and they're cylindrical. So where the connection is, if it's a chemical thing, but I would say, based on very, very small that I know, I would say cylindrical shaped things, whether it is silver or gold or carbon, you know, what are traditionally considered basically non-toxic chemicals. Sodium kind of goes either way. Potassium's great. You know, potassium is a nanoparticle. Crosses our cell barriers all the time, thank goodness, because it does a lot of good things within our body. So, but a lot of those are more of a cylindrical type shape. It appears that those types of shapes, in terms of saying which elements, it depends on whether we're talking about our brain or our kidney or our liver. You know, some nanoparticles really like the liver, okay? I was going to the kidneys first, but really like the liver. And that may be something that we can use to our advantage. Something that may be originally considered a toxic aspect, like, oh my gosh, these particles conglomerate in the liver, and at a certain dosage, at a certain amount of these things in the liver, your liver quits, and that's not a good thing. But on the other hand, if we found a nanoparticle that has an affinity for the liver, is there a way we can treat or coat those specific types of nanoparticles that will go and deposit in the liver to deliver drugs in a very focused way? And that is one of the benefits of nanotechnology also. The potential to have the ability to target very specific regions for drug delivery. So that when I have a sore throat, I take my penicillin, my left big toe gets penicillin whether it needs it or not. But to be able to truly address the region of cancer, the region of unhealthy cells, is something that nanotechnology has a lot of potential at. So that's why I kind of don't like this word toxicity, because dang, something that turns out to be really bad, we may be able to turn it around to our benefit. And then the second part of your question, which I've forgotten.
What products have airborne?
Yeah. Most of the products with nanotechnology, nanoproducts in them, are not airborne. The car wax, the sunscreen, tennis rackets, tennis balls. The tennis rackets and the golf clubs, I believe, do come with a warning that tell you not to saw them. Not to sand them, because those do have carbon nanotubes in them, which give you the flexibility and the lightweight with an amazing strength. Now, why in the world anybody who pays $250 for a, you know, nanotech tennis racket would want to saw it in the first place, unless they had a really bad set or something, you know? But so tires, nanotechnology, nanoparticles have been in tires for 50 years. We've been burning tires for a long time, too. Wonder what's happening there. That's another discussion. But all of the particles that, or all of the products that I can think of, electronics, batteries, thin films, even the silver in Band-Aids, the chemical detectors that are based on nanotechnology, almost everything is in solution. The paint companies that are looking at creating paints that you can put on the wall that have a natural antimicrobial in them, which would make our operating rooms cleaner by a factor of 100 if you've got paint that's helping kill germs and stuff, that is going to be applied with a brush. No spray painting on, for that very reason, because we know it's got nanoparticles in it. And so the safest way to deal with those is to brush paint, roller paint that paint on, and not spray coat it. Same thing over in Singapore. They're painting buildings that have nanoparticles in them that absorb the nitric acid. The poisonous aspects, molecules in smog, get absorbed into this paint because of the nanoparticles, the chemical composition, and it's a titanium dioxide, very similar to the sunscreen. But those chemical particles counteract and neutralize the oxides, the nitric oxides in the smog. Then when it rains, those non-toxic, benign chemicals get washed away with the rain. So in Singapore, they're actually using the paint on their building to help clean up the air. But again, it's in that case where you say, well, we aren't going to spray paint the buildings. We're going to paint it on. So it's... I honestly cannot think of, I mean, there's probably nanoparticles in those little spray pressurized spray cans that you use to clean your computer, but those aren't necessarily man-made nanoparticles. They're oxygen and nitrogen and stuff, so.
One of the things that comes to mind for myself is looking at this, that we do understand that you may not have guidelines in place. That's the whole reason for the or the proposal. Insofar as you do have them in place, though, we want to learn from them and see if there are some ways, you know, come up with some standards. And I think one of the things that will happen is if we have this report, I believe, is back next year, hopefully we'll be able to have an ongoing conversation about, so what are the kinds of standards that would be good for Minnesota to have in place? What agencies should be responsible for helping enforce them or fund them or, you know, help develop the framework? I think just another comment for myself, my own public health background. I think we're talking a lot here about balance. There's microbes that we absolutely need and do not want destroyed by nanoparticles or anything else. They're part of what keeps us alive.
Right.
So microbes are not all bad. They're all good. And the kinds of things that we're talking about, I think, are the unanticipated effects that might come from not having done the studies. I think what disturbs me is to know that the public is not yet informed, either in our agencies or in legislative bodies like this, about what we should be watching for. Mm-hmm. There is not the level of expertise, for example, that you have in a regulatory agency that's helping us decide, yes, this is a very good use, this is over the line, and this really is something we should study some more, or really invest some study in. One of the things that I remember reading about, that really, anybody mentioned it yet, but I presume if we've got companies like, you know, Syngenta and Monsanto and others who do pesticides, some of which we now know there are very serious endocrine disruptor issues that were not announced ahead of time, maybe not even researched or known ahead of time, and they're affecting our population in many ways. And interesting, I know Rochester has worked with Dr. Tyrone Hayes about the Syngenta product, atrazine, and we know that it's related to causing several kinds of cancer. Reproductive cancer. So I just know that when we have commercialization of products that we have not really studied maybe very much ahead of time, we can get into some issues. One area that I've started to mention that I'm a little concerned about is I know that there's a potential in the whole area of bioterrorism for use of some of these kinds of very minute particles that can be put into a solution or a gel or whatever and distributed in ways that, you know, would cause a lot of concern. And I don't know, I do know that our Defense Department that certainly contributes to our universities, to our all different kinds of Defense Department monies coming in. To your knowledge, is there anything going on in that arena in terms of, I'll just say, military use of nanotechnology?
Nationally or within Minnesota?
Either.
I'm not aware of anything in Minnesota, although I have not really sought out a couple places that might, but in general, I'm not aware of that. From a Department of Defense standpoint, nanotechnology is certainly, both sides of that coin
right.
are certainly being addressed by them. And I would say that it's almost a two-thirds on the preventive side, the defensive, in two different ways. One, counteracting. How can you quickly, you know, just like you start a grease fire at home, you know you're supposed to throw baking soda on it and not water, right? That's right, right?
Right.
So looking at the antibodies or that sort of thing. The other area of focus, at least that I'm aware of, is on the detection and measurement, which is a whole other issue that I didn't talk about. It's really hard to measure and observe a 30 nanometer diameter particle. It's not easy. You don't just kind of saunter up to a microscope and twist a few knobs and have this beautiful picture. And so one of the things that DARPA, which is now ARPA, is looking at is a lot of the detection methods for those type of things. And it's interesting because the application of nanotechnology is being applied to detect nanotechnology. For example, Sandia, just one little story, Sandia National Labs has little tiny robotic things. They look like miniature caterpillars. They've literally got the tracks on them that have communication and detection systems on them that have a very short live battery. They're very small. They're smaller than the mini trucks that my son, like think of a block of a Lego block, about that size, movable. You take 1,000 of these, if there is a region that you think has been contaminated from biological terrorism or some other toxic chemical, you set the sensors on these guys to detect those chemicals, you put 1,000 of them into that susceptible room, they communicate back to you the readings that they're getting from their detectors. So rather than send a soldier or a hazmat person or somebody in to make it, you've got these little expendable tools. Another way that they're using them is to find earthquake victims. Set your detector to detect carbon dioxide, throw a whole bunch of these little caterpillar type things that can go over hurdles pretty well, throw them in there, have them detecting carbon dioxide. You might be able to find someone who is still alive buried in the rubble of a building. But there are at least five different aspects of that little caterpillar thing that are come about because of nanotechnology. So using it to detect those things too. But I know that the Department of Defense does have projects that are looking at that.
I think we're just about... Oh, Representative Landon, we're just about out of time, and I do want to have just a couple minutes to hear from the university. But.
Okay. I'm just worried about the regulations standpoint, because when something new and exciting comes forth, there's lots of entrepreneur type of approach to go forth, and we always seem to be six steps behind what's happening, and that can sometimes be devastating. I think of some of the things of... mesothelioma and the tailings in Lake Superior and stuff like this that we still are debating. I think of mercury in thermometers. I mean, I remember as a kid rolling around on the floor. But what change in our perspective that made us say, no, not in the lakes, not in the garbage, you know, on and on. And then even the thing with the pig brains sprayed in... a pig processing plant and they're blasting out the pig brains and inhale them, and they have neurological diseases because the pig brain is so close to the human that the body says, I'll fight myself. And in other words, you take down your own muscular system and neurological dysfunction from it because the pig brain is so close to us. So we get to these little tiny things, and some of them are more like us and some are not, and which ones hurt and which ones don't. My goodness, we've opened a Pandora's box. And yeah. So the question is, I know, and I love academic research, and I trust researchers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes have some debate about this, but I worry about the ones that are for the idea of how can I make a profit. And we know from I'm just learning more and more constantly about the financial crisis we're in on the basis of the lack of regulation that led to people, especially this company called Magnetar, that said, give me the riskiest combined mortgages, right. things that you right. can possibly give right. me, because I'm also buying credit default swaps over here, and I know these are going to go, and I'll be the first on the block to take my so-called insurance policy before this whole house of cards collapses. And they came out very wealthy. The rest of us suffered for generations of families in poverty because they can't get back into the cycle again. So we have our whole society impacted by somebody who said, it's not illegal, and I can make a buck. So I'm just worried about that regulation component.
Short answer if you
yes no I share your concern. There's nothing that we can do. Well, for the stupid greedy people, I think the best thing to do is for those of us that are aware and have the benefit of society over the money aspect, and I'm speaking to myself and not to you, is to get out there and be vocal and be verbal. You know, there's some quote, and I'm going to butcher it horribly, you know, about, yeah, the way to let evil to succeed is for the good to just keep your mouth shut. And one of the things that I think is most important from a nanotechnology standpoint is education of the public. And that is something that I personally feel a huge obligation to get into the schools, I mean, to go to science museums. I talk to more Rotary clubs, and that's a very positive thing. But I've actually also had the experience of an older person coming up to an exhibit at the science museum and saying, oh, what's this? And I say, oh, nanotechnology, nanoscience. Ah, science, I don't get it, and walking away. And it's that person, you know, I'm willing to talk to anybody who will sit and have a dialogue about, and I'm worried about the same thing, and have a dialogue about, golly, it's a two-edged sword. We've got good stuff and bad stuff. How do we separate?
If I can just interrupt you, that the problem is that the people will never care that much. There right. has to be the regulation.
And then we get back to, oh my gosh, I have got a six-dimensional matrix of questions that I have to answer to get to one of those regulations. That's the problem. And I'll gladly take a little bit of funding and go start sorting that out. So,
well, and thank you for your discussion with us. I think it was very helpful. Donna Peterson is here from the University of Minnesota. And Donna, I'm sorry we've run out of time. Would you like to make just some
sure.
summary
I'll
comments
be very
at the
brief.
End? If there's any questions. I just want to give you a chance since you came, and you did answer a couple of questions in the last committee, so I appreciate that, too. And then we're going to conclude, members, and I think maybe this is the first of several discussions, so hopefully we've begun to have
So the record, Donna.
Over here, Ma, did you have a...
I have just a quick question for the testifier. My interest was piqued by Representative Rosenthal's question about airborne. And we know that paint and other things have odors. And is it possible that any of these nanomaterials could be in the, you know, they have chemicals?
Odor molecules are
Excuse me. Can you come up to the microphone?
Oh,
because
sorry.
We are recording this, and we don't want to miss your words of wisdom.
No.
You can stay there, Donna. We're just going to sort of have a comment.
The odors themselves are molecules, but they are lighter weight molecules. More than likely, the things that we call nanoparticles that we put into the paint are going to be chemical compounds that are going to be heavier molecular paint, and they are also designed so that they bind to the paint and do not you create a chemical bond,
sure.
so they're stuck like
okay.
Velcro.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
For the record, Donna Peterson, University of Minnesota. I just want to, a couple of things. One is to apologize that we could not have the appropriate people here today, but they're involved in this conference tomorrow, and it's they have over 200 participants in that conference, and they felt they just could not take time away from finishing up their final details on that. But I just want to give you a brief, listening to your conversation today, just to let you know that the current workshops in the afternoon at this conference, I'm just going to give you the titles, and I think it'll help you know that other people are having these discussions. The first one is Public Engagement, Nanotechnology, Bioethics for Emerging Technologies, Creative Legal and Regulatory Approaches, How Can Oversight Advance Science and Industry, Challenges in Risk Management. And then the final discussion is on next steps. So, and the morning has a lot of what is the science and a lot of discussion of the research that had been done by the folks who are putting on this, because they do oversight and new and emerging technologies. So it's their field of study that are putting this on. So one is, if anyone does have an opportunity to get away tomorrow for any time, please let us know and we'll certainly make arrangements for you to attend. The second thing is, if you want a better understanding of the science of nanotechnology itself, we welcome you to tour, either as a committee or individually, our nanotechnology labs at the university. Opportunity to meet with the researchers who do the research there. What are they working on? What grants do they get? Where do they get them from? And obviously those are the same people who are doing the instructing of the students who are studying in this area. So we would welcome to that opportunity. And then finally, the folks who are putting on this conference would happily have been here today had it not been for that. Yeah. So in a future hearing, we will gladly arrange to have those folks come, because I kind of think that's where you want to concentrate your effort, not as much on the science itself, but on this kind of new and emerging oversight.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I don't know if there's anybody on the committee that wants to attend. You can certainly go and represent all of us and come back, or any of our researchers. So thank you for that invitation. I appreciate it. So, committee members, we are. This is, as I just said, kind of the first shot at looking at these kind of issues, and we will be following it up more. Maybe even taking a tour if that's a good idea. So, we do have before us some minutes from our last meeting on April 15th. Mrs. Lane, did you get a chance to look at them?
Yes,
Okay. Representative Lane moves approval of the minutes of April 13th. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No. Motion prevails, and those minutes are adopted. So thank you, committee members. We have another meeting coming up, not quite sure when, but I thank you all for your time today. Meeting is adjourned.